This is Dave Evans of HearThis.com speaking today with Dr. Cheryl Lee. Dr. Lee received her medical degree at the Albany Medical College, obtained her urologic training at the University of Michigan, and completed fellowship training at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She is currently an associate professor of urology at the University of Michigan. Her main research interest is the development of multimodality strategies to improve the efficacy of surgical therapies treating urologic malignancies. Dr. Lee, regardless of whichever primary therapy chosen, either surgery or radiation, the potential for incontinence and/or impotence is a significant risk. Are there any exercises or medications that can be utilized prior to treatment to minimize these side effects?
I'll be honest with you, every individual is a little different, has different anatomy and a different preoperative functional status in terms of their potency, their ability to have erections, and their urinary control. But let's take someone who is potent and who is starting out with good urinary control. We know that younger patients, younger men who are potent, tend to do better after surgical treatment that preserves the nerves. So that remaining active is a good thing. We don't generally recommend medical therapy prior to surgery in patients who are active. Certainly in patients who have had some declining erectile function, they may already be on a medical therapy or some other type of therapy to help enhance erectile functions. In terms of urinary control, if someone does have borderline control, there are some pelvic rehab exercises that can be done, Kegel exercises, and even biofeedback to help retrain some of the pelvic muscles prior to therapy.
With both incontinence and impotence after surgery, oftentimes return to normalcy occurs after a short period of time. How do you counsel or treat your patients during these situations?
Well, there can truly be a very difficult time period of therapy, in other words, surgical removal of the prostate, and the return to normal function of the urine control and also the sexual function. Part of it certainly does take quite a bit of motivation on the part of the patient. In terms of urinary control, again, many people will have very reasonable but not perfect control within 6 to 12 weeks of surgery. But certainly having to use pads or even liners is not optimal for patients. We encourage, again, pelvic rehabilitation with Kegel exercises. We also have patients enrolled in survivorship workshops to help with some behavioral modifications in terms of drinking of fluids and the timing of fluids and what types of fluids can help to minimize particular areas of concern, such as nighttime leakage. In terms of erectile dysfunction, you know, we certainly encourage the use of erectile aids in the early part of recovery. This can run the gamut from oral therapies to injection therapies to pump therapies. So we encourage stimulation, we encourage activity, all of that to keep the blood flow healthy within the penis and to prevent things like fibrosis. So, you know, again, being as active as possible and also engaging in some of the survivorship counseling to help maintain the necessary motivation to get to the time of recovery.
With radiation therapy, we see delayed onset of both conditions. What can be done to forestall these incidences?
Well, some of the changes that cause these conditions, these delayed conditions after radiation therapy, relate to fibrosis and changes in the immune system in the body. And these changes, unfortunately, cannot fully be avoided. Certainly, in terms of erectile function, activity, again, is a good thing to help prevent even early-stage fibrosis. But, you know, prevention of these types of complications after radiation is a real challenge. Part of this is why radiation therapists and physicists have been trying to improve the radiation oncology technology, moving from the old historic traditional radiation to conformal radiation and even now to what's called an IMRT, or an intensity modulated radiation therapy, where the dose of radiation can be escalated and the neighboring normal tissues can be avoided, with a hope to even avoid tissues like neighboring nerves around the prostate that are important for erectile function.
Despite taking all precautions, severe urinary incontinence may result after surgery. What therapeutic methods would you employ to help the patient regain a better quality of life?
Severe urinary incontinence after surgery fortunately occurs infrequently, less than 3% of patients. When that does occur, it certainly does greatly impact the quality of life. And there certainly comes a point when it's clear that a patient is not on a normal recovery period. And at that point, often, you know, after the failure of things like pelvic rehabilitation, they can be candidates for an evaluation of their bladder and urethra to determine what some of the very specific problems are. And if it's some of the typical problems where the important pelvic muscles aren't functioning well, we need to consider other therapies such as the use of collagen injection therapy or the placement of an artificial urinary sphincter or even the use of a urinary sling to tent up the neck of the bladder to offer much better control to the patient. So there certainly comes a point where it's clear that the urine control is not going to be optimal. And in cases of severe incontinence, we should not hesitate to use other therapies to improve the quality of life.
Sexual potency and the ability to have an erection suitable for intercourse goes to the essence of male self-image. What protocols are utilized to address this side effect?
Well, certainly after treatment, there's likely to be some erectile dysfunction, even in the patient who has had adequate therapy to preserve nerves important in erections. Different centers around the country certainly have different protocols, but many of them are focused on early sexual activity and the use of things like oral agents, Viagra, Cialis, Levitra, any of those types of drugs, in addition to stimulation, can really help maintain the tissues so that as recovery occurs, the patient can ultimately achieve a near normal erection. You know, having said that, it's important to really take advantage of the concept of survivorship clinics, and we have, as part of our surgical protocol, a series of counseling sessions with a sex therapist, with a sociologist, and with a nurse practitioner to help counsel on which types of treatments can be beneficial in this early period while they're recovering, but also to give counseling to their partner and also to address some of the issues that relate to self-image, ego, and these types of things.
Even under the best of circumstances, at minimum, there will be instances of stress incontinence, either urinary or fecal. How do you counsel patients to manage this condition?
Well, unfortunately, fecal incontinence is rare. After surgical treatment, though, there can be some changes in the gastrointestinal function after radiation therapy primarily. But we're looking at some of the same types of techniques. Again, maintaining activity in a survivorship community or survivorship clinic is helpful. But in the early part of recovery, trying to really enhance pelvic rehabilitation through mechanical exercises is important. And again, maintaining the motivation of the patient to know that though in the early part they may be using supportive devices like pads, that, you know, within several weeks that should really improve dramatically. So some of it is communication and counseling to take part in some of the survivorship clinics to really explain in detail what's going on and then also taking advantage of things like pelvic rehabilitation. But for the vast majority of patients, there's going to be a relatively quick recovery period for incontinence.
We're seeing the use of hormonal therapy neoadjuvantly in conjunction with radiation or surgical treatment prior and post. How do you address the fact that hormonal therapy can have effects leading to bone density loss as well as an increase in the risk of diabetes and heart disease?
That's a good question, because there has been an increasing use of hormonal therapy or androgen ablation. And over time, we've seen that the long-term use can be associated with a number of physiologic changes, including bone density loss, and also, more recently, some other effects regarding metabolic syndrome and diabetes and heart disease. But some of it is really a risk versus reward ratio that has to be considered. And every patient may have their own unique set of comorbidities that would make these types of side effects more likely. I think the thing to remember is that the short-term use of these types of drugs to help with androgen ablation don't have the same associations as the long-term use of the androgen deprivation. So long-term hormonal use, yes, there are certainly several risks to be considered, and others as well in terms of mood, depression, other side effects of treatment, including breast tenderness, and some other physical changes. Though we do have some medications to offset some of these things, there are certainly risks. And I think we just have to weigh the risk of the benefit of the disease from the risk factors that relate to any individual patient.
When should a patient move from their primary physician, either a urologist or radiation oncologist, to seek the counsel and services of a specialist in managing side effects? How are the specialists identified and best located?
The hope would be that one's urologist or radiation oncologist would have existing relationships with specialists who manage side effects such as erectile dysfunction or incontinence. And certainly many urologists manage these very same problems. So it is definitely dependent upon your provider. Let's say you're seeing a specialist and they don't manage these types of treatment side effects, then it is very reasonable for a patient, certainly by the six-month mark, to start asking questions about how to proceed if the side effects don't improve. We know that incontinence and impotence can improve up to 12 to 18 months after surgical treatment. Radiation, some of these side effects are being experienced years later, and so that situation is a little bit simpler, and the fact that radiation therapists don't generally manage those conditions, again, it's simpler. They tend to get referred back to a urologist. From the surgical standpoint, if, you know, by 6 months there should be some improvement in the side effects. If there's severe incontinence, for example, at 6 months, that's not improving. That's not an unreasonable time to start getting some bladder testing done. Now, the subspecialist doing that type of testing may not want to implement the formal treatment yet with the hopes that things may get better, but depending on what's found on the evaluation, they may feel that things won't get better. So, you know, certainly by 6 months in terms of urinary control, if it's severe, then that's not an unreasonable time to begin seeing another specialist. In terms of erectile function, I would say probably a year is a better time period to seek specialty advice. Now, having said that, there's generally no reason why a patient can't be somewhat active in that period while recovery is occurring in that first year, even after surgical treatment. There are several erectile aids that can be used while a patient is awaiting their own recovery of their own function.
What are the key questions that a patient should ask their surgeon or radiation oncologist before primary therapy?
I think it's important for patients to be aware of their disease. So they should be asking their provider about their cancer stage, in other words, the extent of the cancer, their tumor grade or how aggressive it's going to be, what their prognosis would be like if they undergo a specific treatment. And there are several nomograms now available to try to help predict how well a patient will do. The patient should be clearly aware of the risks of the treatment and the likelihood of developing side effects like incontinence or impotence, and specifically the rates of that provider. It's very easy to quote the national and international results of radical prostatectomy. However, that patient should know the results of that provider. In addition, it's important to know how many procedures the provider may have performed, or if it's a radiation doctor, how many patients they've treated. And what is the technique of the treatment for surgery? Is it open prostatectomy, perineal, laparoscopic, robotic? For radiation therapy, is it standard radiation? Is it conformal? Is it IMRT? So what is the detail of the treatment? And then the patient should also try to determine what is the provider's plan to manage complications should they happen, or to manage very common toxicities such as incontinence and impotence. In other words, at what time point would they expect to see another provider? At what time point would they expect to recover their function, et cetera? So really knowing about the disease, knowing about the treatment specifically, what type of volume that provider has, and what their results have been.
What are some of the new emerging protocols that offer an improved risk factor relative to side effects occurrence?
Well, for radiation, I would say really probably the biggest development or emerging protocol is the IMRT, which, again, is the intensity-modulated radiation therapy. It essentially is allowing for increasing doses of radiation therapy to the prostate while reducing toxicity. So we know that if there's an increasing dose of radiation delivered to the prostate, then generally there's a better treatment rate of the cancer. So that's probably one of the most important advances for radiation therapy in the recent past. For surgery, it's a little less clear. There's the sense that the use of robotic prostatectomy could help with visualization and resection of the prostate such that nerves could better be spared and, in theory, improve the rates of continence and potency. That hasn't actually borne out in many studies, in part because the results with open prostatectomy have been so good and robotic is being compared with the standard of open prostate surgery. So right now, it's not clear that robotic surgery is going to have a major impact on those main toxicities, but with further advances in the robotic technique, it may be that ultimately there is some benefit. But that has been the newest technical change for surgery. The only other issue that I would mention that covers both radiation and surgery is the emergence of survivorship protocols and clinics where patients really can be counseled about their side effects, how to treat the side effects, and how to manage around those side effects. Those types of environments can help really address issues of patient fatigue and family fatigue and spousal or other partner concerns, and at the same time help counsel during the recovery period and then even afterwards. Many of these survivorship clinics also have relationships with support groups, which is also important to help patients get a broader sense of other people that are experiencing similar types of treatment issues. So I would say that would probably be another protocol that's emerged and is really growing nationally that really does address issues related to surgery and radiation.
Thank you, Dr. Lee. We've been speaking today with Dr. Cheryl Lee about managing treatment side effects. On behalf of everyone at the ProstateNet, thank you so much for taking your time to speak with us today. Thanks as well to our listeners for taking the time to learn more about prostate health and the difference they can make in their own life for the benefit of themselves, their friends, and family in the community to which they belong. This podcast is a copyrighted production of ProstateNet and HearThis.com. All rights are reserved.